Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Conservative New York Times columnist David Brooks says his friends who are Democrats often ask him why Republicans have become so extreme, so fevered. Republicans don't have an illness, says Brooks. They have a viewpoint that the U.S. needs a radical reset, that our governing model is obsolete, that we need to sharply cut back social welfare spending and entitlements to reboot for the 21st century. The definitive expression of that sentiment, he says, comes from conservative thinker and essayist Yuval Levin. He's with us. This hour on Point, Yuval Levin says, let's whack government spending, loosen the reins on healthcare, energy, finance, and education. Let's get lean and reboot for the 21st century. You can join the conversation. Is a radical paring back of government entitlements and regulation what the country needs to be competitive in this century? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later in the hour, we'll be joined for debate by Robert Kuttner, co-editor of The American Prospect. Joining me now from Washington is Yuval Levin. His essay in the Weekly Standard, Our Age of Anxiety, caught the attention of New York Times columnist David Brooks, who called it the definitive essay outlining America's problems and how the Republican Party, with Mitt Romney at its helm, could fix them. Levin is founding editor of National Affairs, the Quarterly Journal, and a former member of the White House domestic policy staff under President George W. Bush. Yuval Levin, thanks very much for joining us today.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Our Age of Anxiety, your big essay, is titled Whose Anxiety and What's Driving It?
Well, it's voter anxiety above all. You know, the essay came out of a sense of perplexity at the way in which this election so far seems to be happening in an alternate universe. Neither one of the candidates seems to be addressing himself to the real concerns that voters are expressing in polls. Extraordinary concerns, fundamental concerns about the future of the country that reach far beyond worries about how we're coming out of the current recession. And yet, if you listen to President Obama's campaign, and if that's all you knew about America, you would think that things are basically fine. We're nearing the triumph of the liberal welfare state if only a few retrograde conservatives would get out of the way. And if you listen to Mitt Romney, you would think that everything was fine until we elected the wrong president who doesn't believe in the American way of life. And if only we could get rid of him, things would be fine again. Well, that's just not so. The fact is that voter anxiety is rooted in a reality, in the reality that the kind of growth that we have had, economic growth, in the post-war decades that we all grew up in, may not be possible now without some very fundamental reforms of the way that we think about our economy and govern our economy. And those kinds of reforms are necessary yet are not being proposed by President Obama and are not being very openly proposed by Mitt Romney. So what I tried to argue in the essay is that what's required is a different vision of how to think about economic policy, one that would be more suitable to Romney than Obama, but that really isn't being advanced by either candidate in this election so far.
You say the problem goes back more than 3 or 4 years under President Obama, that it goes back to the Great Society vision of the 1960s, all the way back maybe to the New Deal. What is it you want to root out or change or lop off, or what's failing in your view?
Well, what's failing on the one hand is the liberal welfare state itself, and it's failing in a very straightforward fiscal or economic sense. The federal government is going bankrupt. It's going bankrupt largely paying for health care through our existing health care entitlements, and of course we've made that somewhat worse with the Affordable Care Act enacted a few years ago. It's also failing to allow for innovation, to allow for the kind of economic growth that we will need to compete in the 21st century. What we need is a modernization of our public sector, but also a modernization of our private sector. And in many respects, government has stood in the way of that, not just in the last 3 or 4 years. It's important to say, I don't blame President Obama for this problem. I blame him for resisting a solution, which he has staunchly done, unfortunately. But it's certainly not a problem he created. It is a problem, though, that I think will require a different president to begin to address, because this president is very committed to the status quo, to keeping our existing entitlement system, to increasing the tax burden on investment and employment, to bringing more of the economy into the public sector, to a kind of regulatory agenda aimed at consolidation rather than growth. So I do think we need a change in Washington. But we need a change in Washington not just from the past 4 years. We need to think about what the American economy looks like beyond the welfare state, which is, whatever you think of it, crumbling all around us.
When you say the welfare state, you're not limited to what people used to think of as welfare that Bill Clinton went after in the 1990s. You're really talking about the sort of big buffet of entitlements that people have become quite accustomed to, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security.
Yeah,
you're looking at that.
In fact, that it is exactly those middle-class entitlements that are in some respects the biggest problem. So yes, when I talk about the welfare state, I mean the broad kind of dream of social democracy, of ensconching the citizen in a series of benefits from the cradle to the grave that would allow us to eliminate material needs, that would allow us to build a sense of solidarity. It's a vision that inspired our politics for a long time and that has inspired European politics even more profoundly. But it's a vision that's turning out to be very problematic, that has created a lot of social problems through those welfare programs that are intended for the poor. But
welfare like Social Security and Medicare?
No, I mean, when I talk about social problems, I mean the ways in which the federal government has sought to help the poor, well-motivated, no doubt, but ways that have done a lot of harm to family structure among the poor in America and that have, in some respects, been reformed. We went through a significant welfare reform in the 1990s. But again, it goes well beyond that. I think middle-class entitlements are a huge problem for a free society. And middle-class entitlements are also incredibly regressive. If you think about Social Security and Medicare, the two largest programs in the federal budget today, those two programs move money from young people to old people, which used to mean moving money from people who had more to people who had less. But it hasn't meant that in a long time in America. Today, it means moving money from people who are less wealthy to people who are more wealthy. The programs are not means-tested to any significant degree, and they're extremely inefficient. Medicare, much more than Social Security. Medicare is the chief driver of the inefficiency of our healthcare system that's causing costs to go up, that's driving people to become uninsured. Medicare has to be reformed. There's no way out of our fiscal problems without a real structural reform of the Medicare system. That really is at the core of it. And again, that's why I think that we would need a new president, because President Obama has made it very clear that he's committed to opposing any structural reform of Medicare, that his economic agenda involves keeping the Medicare system in place, but maybe putting a board of price controllers on top of the existing system. It's the kind of thing that has failed for decades in Medicare, and that I think we cannot get out of our fiscal problem without addressing the basic fundamental structural flaw in that particular entitlement.
I can imagine some listeners cheering for the idea of big cuts, and many others, if the polls are right, wondering what kind of world this would create without those programs you're describing.
Yeah, well,
Medicare.
I certainly am not talking about...
And without regulation as well. I mean, it can sound kind of dog-eat-dog. Paint the picture. Why do you want to get rid of those, and what would we have instead?
That's what I was saying, then certainly that would be a problem. But I'm certainly not talking about a world without Medicare, let alone a world without regulation. On the contrary, I think it makes sense for the federal government to have a large program that's intended to help senior citizens be able to afford health coverage. I think the Medicare program needs to survive, and the only way for it to survive is through structural reform. It cannot survive the way it is now. President Obama has acknowledged as much himself. It needs to change the way that it finances health care. And so I'm not suggesting that we not have a Medicare program, or even that we not have a large Medicare program, but it needs to be a program that empowers seniors to function as consumers in our healthcare system, that provides them with a benefit, a government benefit, that is large enough to fund comprehensive coverage, but that they can then use to choose among private insurers. Basically, turn around all of the economic incentives in today's Medicare system so that we end up with a system that encourages innovation, encourages competition, encourages the development of a much more efficient health sector. In area after area of our economy, the problem we have is profound, gross inefficiency. It's especially so in healthcare. That inefficiency is what drives costs to go up so much, and that in turn is why we have such a huge problem of the uninsured and why we have such a huge fiscal problem in the federal government.
Well, I wonder if that's exactly the reason for the uninsured. But you're right. You say the private economy is not exactly getting geared for efficiency either. What do you see
Absolutely.
Going on there? What?
Yeah, absolutely. The private economy is burdened in a number of ways. First of all, we have what you might call a human capital policy in our country that has denied American business a workforce capable of competing in the 21st century.
You're really talking immigration when you say
that. And education. I think maybe more so education. Our education system is not well geared to producing the workers of tomorrow. Everybody acknowledges that. I don't think that's controversial. Obviously, what to do about it raises some controversies. But I think we have serious problems with our education system. The immigration system as well is, at this point, basically being used to import competitors from abroad for the workers who are suffering most in this economic period. But at the same time,
low-wage workers.
Yeah, low-wage workers. And at the same time is denying high-skill workers where they're very badly needed. And so I think it's basically economically backwards and needs to be rethought in a way that would better suit our economic needs of the moment. We also, I do think, have a regulation problem. I'm certainly not suggesting that we simply roll back regulation. I don't think too much or too little is the right way to think about regulation. What we need are economic regulations that encourage competition. That's really the purpose of regulation, is to keep a competitive market in place, not to allow larger players to have too much of an advantage, not to allow anybody in the system, whether it be big labor, big business, or big government, to simply control the system for their own benefit. Today, we don't have that regulatory system, and in fact, we're moving in a very different direction. We're moving towards a kind of state capitalism where precisely big labor, big government, and big business work together to manage the economy, to consolidate the economy. But what we need is a regulatory system that is geared for growth, which means that it needs to encourage innovation, to encourage new players, to encourage competition. It needs to be a robust regulatory system. I would certainly not argue that what we simply need is less regulation. But we need a very different kind of regulation, pro-market more than pro-business.
And the market, your point is, would do it, would make us a competitor in the 21st century.
Properly regulated, properly thought about, I think it would. I think it would certainly do a better job than our existing system.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the conservative impulse to hit the reset button on American life, to radically pare back government and entitlements and push to restart American business. My guest is Yuval Levin. He's a contributing editor at the Weekly Standard. His big essay there, Our Age of Anxiety, has gotten a lot of attention since it came out last week. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org, and read it in full. It says in part, here's Levin writing, we have a sense that the economic order we knew in the second half of the 20th century may not be coming back at all, that we have entered a new era for which we've not been well prepared. We are rather on the cusp, he writes, of the fiscal and institutional collapse of our welfare state, he says, which threatens not only the future of government finances, but also the future of American capitalism. Yuval Levin, writing in the Weekly Standard. Robert Kuttner of the American Prospect joins us in a moment. Yuval Levin is with us from Washington. Yuval, we've got a lot of response here to you online, if I may share some with you. Quadraticus writes, it's great that there are people finally willing to talk about this and get airtime, but I think it's mostly unnecessary, this listener writes. Substantial paring down of government will happen because the modern social welfare state is unsustainable, period. On the other end, we've got Greg writes, what liberal welfare state? There isn't one in America. This guy, you, is another propagandist for the criminal elite to want you to be their, who want you to be their serfs. And then kind of in between, Yuval, Alex writes, I like the idea of smaller government, sympathize with libertarians. But having a smaller government seems crazy at this point with the power corporations have and the concentration of wealth among a few who can easily pull the strings of a weakened central government. Reducing the size now would take more political power away from the poor, middle class, and workers who barely have any power as it is. At this point, it sounds like utopian fantasy. What about that sympathetic listener who at the same time worries about the balance of power in this country, Yuval?
Well, I think that the idea that a larger government is a counterweight to big business and big corporations is a mistake, and that it's proven to be a mistake by considering what we've seen in the past few years. The fact is big government and big business work together. They don't work against one another. What we need is a competitive economy where smaller competitors, where innovators, where people with new ideas, new models of how to do business have a chance to compete. What we have instead is a government that for the sake of some understandable purposes of managing the economy as they understand it, a government that regulates for the sake and the benefit of larger businesses against competition. So I'm certainly not arguing that we should roll back government to allow big business to reign. I'm suggesting that we rethink government, that we reform government. It's not simply about size, though I do think these reforms would result in a smaller government. but it's about the kind of government we want to have and the purposes that we want to have for our economic policies. I think the purpose of American economic policy should be to allow for economic growth, which is the way to help everyone, to help the poor, first of all. Economic growth and capitalism have been the greatest benefactors of the poor in human history, but also to help the middle class and to help our country thrive and compete. I don't think we're doing that very well now, and I think a big part of the reason does have to do with the kind of inefficiency that's imposed on our economy by the kind of government we have. Again, I don't blame this president for that alone. I don't blame even one party for that. It has certainly been created by Republicans and Democrats together over the course of the entire post-war era. But I do think that it's time to think again about what we need to do, precisely because some kind of rethinking will be forced on us by the sheer scope of our fiscal problem, which is the point that the first of your listeners made. I do think that's right, but it doesn't make sense to just wait for that, because in an emergency, we're not going to make very good decisions. It makes sense to think now about what American life looks like beyond the welfare state.
Hasn't President Obama, in fact, offered on this front to move? I mean, last summer when we had the big budget standoff, wasn't he offering to raise the eligibility age for Medicare to 67, for example? John Boehner, just wouldn't go for it when the backbenchers rebelled there in Congress. I mean, you say he's not willing to budge, but didn't it seem last summer like he was trying to move?
Well, first of all, it's not quite how I remember what happened last summer. I think John Boehner was willing to go for it, but at the end of the day, congressional Democrats were not. But however that went, I think raising the eligibility age of the existing Medicare system without reforming the system would make a very small difference. And in fact, if you think about it, Medicare is an insurance system. So taking out the youngest people in that system actually increases overall cost, doesn't reduce overall cost. But what's really needed is a structural reform of Medicare, because what Medicare does is force a fee-for-service business model on all of American medicine, quite apart from care for the elderly alone. All of American medicine today follows a business model that is extremely inefficient. It pays physicians by how much they do and therefore encourages the growth of volume, which then encourages the growth of costs, inflates costs, and therefore puts coverage and care out of the reach of more and more people. That's why we have 50 million people uninsured in America.
Because of Medicare? Really?
Not because of Medicare, because of the inefficiency of our healthcare system. The reason we have the healthcare problem presents itself in two facets that are both moral and economic, and that seem at first to contradict one another. On the one hand, we have a huge number of uninsured people, and it's growing. On the other hand, we have our existing healthcare entitlement programs going bankrupt. So one would suggest that we need to spend more money on healthcare. The other would suggest we need to spend less money on healthcare. And, of course, the left and the right emphasize different ones.
Number of insured coming down with the new healthcare reform, we're told, coming down substantially.
We are told, but healthcare costs won't come down. We're told that, too. And healthcare costs are what drive the uninsured. We cannot resolve this problem without controlling the inflation of healthcare costs, the year-over-year growth of healthcare costs.
Hold the thought right there. Yuval Levin's big piece is Our Age of Anxiety, and he's looking right across the board at regulation, at spending, entitlement, Social Security, Medicare, finance regulation, you name it, saying we need to get lean to win in this century, or the anxiety, we're on a path to decline. We've got a lot of listeners calling in for you, Yuval. MD in New Britain, Connecticut, you're on the air with Yuval Levin.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
All right. What do you think?
I have 2 points I want to drive home. First of all, I'm also an eternal optimist as President Obama. And my first point is that quality brings quantity, but quantity doesn't bring quality. That's my first point. My second point about education, the true factor behind that is not teaching students what to think, but it's teaching them how to think, critical thinking.
What about investment? Do you think the market will take care of investing in our 21st century future, MD?
It will when we start to operate under the premise of knowing the difference between needs versus wants. When we do that, capitalism has seeds of excess within it. It will be unlocked through different programs.
MD, thanks for your call. Let me get one more, if I may, in Iowa City, Iowa. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Your guest sounds like a Marxist theorist. in the line of Charles Wright, or Charles Reach, how you pronounce his name. He wrote the book called The Greening of America, and he wrote a second book who have mapped out how the system should be dismantled. So
This was like a love letter to the 60s counterculture, his book.
Yeah, so it's Marxist theory. It's a reworking of Marxist theory.
What do you mean Marxist? It's market-driven, Yuval Levin is saying. What do you mean Marxist?
I'm talking about Karl Marx.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I know.
And the Marxist theory and the Marxists that followed him, you know, in their writing, especially Charles Wright. And so what he's talking about goes back to the 30s, talking about dismantle the government, so on and so on and so forth. So it's nothing new.
Mary, I appreciate your call. I'm not sure how we go Marxist, but let's get one more.
That's certainly the first time I've been accused of being a Marxist theorist, so that's nice.
Put that on your lapel. One more. Montreal, yeah. Canada. Josh, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, the kind of ideas the very eloquent gentleman is advocating remind me of somebody else, of Milton Friedman and the Chicago Boys, the neoliberal kind of policies of cutting back government spending. This kind of stuff is really nothing new either. So it's just going to decimate the middle class, hurt the poorest of the poor, and enrich the richest of the rich, in my view.
Josh, thanks. Yuval, what do you say?
Well, I certainly wouldn't claim it's new. I agree with that much. But I also don't think that it would hurt the poor or the middle class. I think that, again, the core of my argument is not about how much. It's not simply about the size. It's about what government is for, what its purpose is. And as far as economic policy, I think the purpose of government is to enable prosperity. Enabling prosperity helps the poor. It has helped the poor more than anything else has in the history of the world. And enabling prosperity also allows us to have a broad middle class. Now, obviously, there's a large debate to be had about what enabling prosperity means. That is our economic debate. I think that what we're doing now, that the kind of regulation that is being put into place that empowers large business over small business, that the resistance to reforms of our entitlement state does not enable prosperity. It stands in the way of the kind of growth we're going to need. The fact is the circumstances we're in, quite apart from anything the government is doing, are going to make the sort of growth we had in the post-war era very difficult to sustain. Very difficult to get back.
You remind us that we had over 3% a year on average after World War II. That went down in the 2000s, George Bush time, to 1.7, down to 0.6% between 2009 and 2011 with the bust then.
And let's think about why, right? Economic growth basically consists of two things. It consists of the growth of the labor market, the growth of the workforce, and it consists of improvements in efficiency. Now, in the post-war years, our workforce was growing by leaps and bounds. The baby boomers came into the workforce, then women came into the workforce in huge numbers, and the growth of the workforce accounted for about half of the economic growth we had in that period. Again, more than 3% per year economic growth, which is incredible. The other half came from productivity improvements, from technological revolutions in communication, and then computers, and then the internet. This is the kind of thing that's going to be very hard to repeat. Our workforce is not going to grow in the coming decades the way it did in the previous several decades because we don't have the baby boomers coming into the workforce. We have them going out of it. And the number of women in the workforce has plateaued some. So economic growth is going to have to come from productivity improvements. That means that we need to gear ourselves for an explosion of productivity across the economy. And we are not well geared for that explosion of productivity now.
Pat in Boston, you're on the air with Yuval Levin.
Hi, Tom. A question. I'll take my answer off the air.
Yep.
Where does your guest see the role of defense and defense spending in his vision of government? Because right now, that is more than a quarter or more of our national sort of government spending, and a lot of it is tied into big business interests. Thank you.
Yeah, it's very large. What about cutting on that front, Yuval, or not, in your picture?
Absolutely. I think there are definitely savings to be had in the defense budget. Now, the defense budget as a share of our government has been declining quite rapidly for a long time. It used to be a very, very much larger share of government spending in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s. It's much less so now, but it's still a very large budget item.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. It's still enormous. It's still larger even than Social Security at this point, a little bit. And I do think there are places to save. But look, defense is the first purpose of the federal government. And so I do think that defense is something that needs to be sustained at a level that can serve the national interest. And obviously we elect people to decide what that national interest is and what it looks like. But I think that the basic problem we have, the growing problem we have, the reason that our fiscal situation is not sustainable really is our health care entitlements. So let me give you a few numbers if you have a minute for them. 40 years ago, 1971, federal health spending, Medicare and Medicaid basically, was 1% of our gross domestic product, 1% of our economy. And everything else combined, defense, Social Security, discretionary, everything but interest on the debt was 17.1%. Last year, 2011, 40 years later, healthcare spending was 5.6% of GDP, so 5.5 times as much. And everything else combined was 17.1% of GDP, exactly what it had been 40 years earlier. Now, that number has gone up and down some over the years, but not much. And last year, it was exactly where it was 40 years earlier, which means that the entire growth of government as a share of the economy over the last 40 years has been a function of health spending. And the coming decades look just like that.
Let me get a caller on just that point. Brian in Des Moines, Iowa. You're on with Yuval Levin.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay, what do you think, Brian?
Yeah, my point was the two last ones I've dealt with a little bit. I have no problem as a left moderate dealing with issues of both Social Security and Medicare, but the military spending, and also the massive wealth disparity that's just come on in the last 20 years. I mean, it's just boomed. I mean, we should be dealing with that first and then deal with these issues. And it's something that we haven't been at this level of income and wealth disparity since 1929. We know what happened after that.
Yep.
The other issue I wanted to point out real quickly, is this idea that this health care is a burden that just should not be shared. And we should be focusing on that before focusing on these other countries. I looked at the tax returns and the deficit spending from Reagan on. What I found out was interesting because when the capital gains went down, there was this massive influx of federal receipts coming from people basically getting rid of their assets, and they figured it was going to go turn around.
Right.
And then the wad was shot, and then it went down. But then when Clinton came along, all the rich people figured out, hey, this is a good idea. And then you start seeing the percent of our receipts growing exponentially from capital gains as opposed to income. I mean, we should be dealing with this issue. Romney paid 15%. Let's deal with that first.
Let's look at the inequalities. Brian, we've got it, and I'll come to inequality. If I may, I want to bring another voice into our conversation. First, Robert Kuttner joins us from Truro, Massachusetts, co-editor of The American Prospect, blogger for The Huffington Post, author of A Presidency in Peril. Robert Kuttner, thanks for joining us. What do you make of Yuval Levin's big critique?
Well, Tom, thanks for having me. I think inequality is a good point for me to come in. Because reading his essay, you'd never know that for the first 30 years after the war, productivity growth and wage growth rose in lockstep. And since the Reagan years, it's been paradise for billionaires, and wage and salary growth has been flat for regular people, even though productivity growth continued very nicely right through the 90s. You'd also never know that George W. Bush was president after 2001, precisely the period when economic growth faltered, according to Mr. Levin, and further that Mr. Bush pursued exactly the same kinds of policies that Mr. Levin is commending as something new. And you'd also never know, in the discussion of regulation, that the recession that led to the slow growth and the anxiety was triggered by a financial collapse that occurred before Barack Obama was elected, and that was the fruit of a couple of decades of deregulation. So we can talk about, I mean, I'd agree with him that corporations have captured a lot of the process of regulation, that we need a different kind of regulation, but it is a kind of studied denial of what's been going on for the past 20 or 30 years, most of which, by the way, was a period when Republicans were in power, either in the White House or in Congress, pursuing exactly the kind of policies that he's commending. So I would say it was those policies that account for the fact that we're in as much trouble as we're in.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the conservative impulse to hit the reset button on American life, to radically pare back government and entitlements and push to restart American Business. Yuval Levin's written a big essay for the Weekly Standard called Our Age of Anxiety. David Brooks, conservative columnist in the New York Times, says this is it. This is the definitive expression of an urge to pare way, way back, get lean, and become more competitive in the 21st century. But does it work that way? Also joining us today, Robert Kuttner, co-editor of the American Prospect, author of A Presidency in Peril. All kinds of response here, Yuval. Robert, Christina writes, it's an interesting conversation, one I can listen to because Yuval's respectful, staying away from hyperbole. Okay, there's one there. But then we've got some tough ones. Rob asks, where is the huge surplus, Mr. Levin, that Bill Clinton left us? Could it be in Iraq with Halliburton, Exxon Mobil, J.P. Morgan, Chase, Bank of America, all a result of your deregulate, screw the poor small government model? Yuval, what do you say?
Well, it's nice to stay away from hyperbole, if nothing else. Look, I think that it was already clear by 2000 that the surplus was going away because we had failed to reform entitlements in the 1990s. And I say we because Republicans had at least as much to do with that as Democrats. There was an opportunity in the late 90s to push for reforms of the Medicare system. There was even an attempt, but it didn't go far enough. They stopped very far short. I was working on Capitol Hill on these issues at the time, and I know that at the end of the day, it was a missed opportunity. And we ended up with a situation where we are now looking at utterly unsustainable debt coming in the future because of the shape and structure and trajectory of our healthcare entitlements. And if we don't address those, we can't fix the problem. That's the essence of what needs to be done. And unfortunately, there's tremendous resistance to that on the left today. President Obama has made clear that he doesn't want to consider structural reforms as part of any budget negotiations. To their credit, Republicans have now proposed real reforms of Medicare. They may be politically dangerous.
Paul Ryan and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Paul Ryan and so on. I think those are great ideas. They need to be negotiated out in Congress, as all major legislation would be. But there hasn't been that process of negotiation because there's been absolutely no willingness on the left to consider these ideas. Very few Democrats, really only one right now, Ron Wyden, the senator from Oregon, has been willing to say that some form of this could work. And
you
all
stand by. I want
to
get Bob Kuttner in here. But what about the essential argument here, Robert Kuttner, that what's needed for this century is to get some of government out of the way so you can unleash the creative potential of the American people through the markets and thereby, with that leaner, less onerously regulated, engine of private industry, be the competitor on the world stage, lift all boats? What about it?
Well, it's an old chestnut of an argument between liberals and conservatives. Liberals will typically point to things that government has done that facilitated entrepreneurship, all kinds of research subsidies. There's one thing that Mr. Levin said that I can't let go by because it's a misstatement of fact. The Clinton surplus was blown away not because of Social Security, but half of it was blown away by the two Bush tax cuts that were tilted upwards. The other half was blown away by the defense buildup. And you recall in 2000, 2001, Greenspan was worried that we'd have such a big surplus that we'd pay off the national debt and then they couldn't do monetary policy. I think the second misstatement of fact is on fee-for-service medicine. What about the HMO revolution? I mean, HMOs, health maintenance organizations, are prepaid health care. They're commercially sponsored, and it's well documented that Medicare costs have risen at a slower rate than private insurance costs. I mean, if competition were the key to driving down medical costs, there's plenty of competition right now in the private sector, part of health insurance, and even Medicare, thanks to President Bush. Now you can opt to use your Medicare to buy HMO coverage. About 20% of people do, and that part of Medicare is inflating at a more rapid rate, less efficient delivery of health care than public Medicare. So I think a lot of what he is proposing has been tried and has been found wanting.
How do we get to more growth, Robert Kuttner, to support the kind of programs that you and many others would like to see sustained? I mean, the numbers do look pretty difficult when you look at it. How do we get to that growth?
Well, we're in a very steep recession that was triggered by a financial collapse. So I think we've got to cure that. We've got to reform finance. We've got to have all these Wall Street manipulators of paper play a more constructive role in the economy. And I think once we get this recession behind us, which was triggered by a collapse on Wall Street, then we can have a very interesting debate about the best way to get productivity growth back up. And I think that's the debate, that's the real long-term debate that we ought to be having. I don't think getting government out of the way is the way to do that. I mean, there so much of what industry has lived off of since World War II that has been the result of social investment, public investment, investment in human capital, investment in R&D, investment in infrastructure. Some of that has been an accidental spin-off of the Cold War. But to say that all we have to do is get government out of the way and the economy will thrive, if that were the case, the Reagan Revolution and the Bush II Revolution would have produced massive increases in productivity growth, and they did just the opposite.
Why weren't they there, Yuval?
Well, I'm certainly not arguing that getting government out of the way is the solution to the problem. I think getting government behind the cause of growth is the solution to the problem.
Out of the way seems to me a fair summary of a lot of what you're writing in this essay.
Well, I beg to differ. What I'm suggesting is reforms of our governing institutions that allow them to work in tandem with a thriving competitive market economy.
But you want to cut way back. I mean, you're saying it's in the way. It's right. I'm staring at it right here.
I'm suggesting that, for example, the Medicare system, and I do want to get back to Bob's point about Medicare, which I think doesn't get the facts quite right, but I'm suggesting that the Medicare system is in the way in the sense that it imposes a very inefficient business model on American healthcare.
Do you see a better one that's been produced by some other, you know, private market mechanism out there?
Well, I don't think there is a private market in healthcare in America, or that there can be, because Medicare is by far the largest payer for healthcare in every health market in the United States. And so as long as its fee-for-service system is the dominant model, everyone has to work by it.
But all doctors are complaining about how low that fee-for-service is, not
exactly.
How...
Exactly. They're paid very little for each service, and so they have to push up the volume of their services, which creates a very inefficient healthcare system.
I want to ask you on the finance
front. They should
be
paid by value. They should be paid by what they produce and by how patients value what they get from
them. We got it. You're very down on the Dodd-Frank regulations in here, and you say get government out of the hair of finance in so many ways. And I'm curious about, I mean, right now we look around, we've got this J.P. Morgan, you know, sort of overnight loss of $2 billion, $9 billion, I don't know, with risky trades. You've got Barclays Bank. This is in the U.K., but never mind. Manipulating interest rates, the CEO resigning there. You've got the collapse that Bob Cutner talked about that threw us all back on our heels so deeply in 08, 09. How do we get out of oversight there to keep, you know, the banks from kind of driving us in a ditch? They've done it.
Absolutely. I'm definitely not suggesting that we need less regulation of the financial sector. I'm suggesting we need a very different kind of regulation of the financial sector. And unfortunately, the core of what Dodd-Frank's would do or has begun to do is to enshrine in law the policy of too big to fail. And that played a part, not the only part by any means, but played a part in the collapse that we experienced. And unfortunately, what we've done here is move toward a more kind of state capitalist model where we say we need just a few large banks that the regulators can manage, can deal with, and we need to keep smaller competitors out of their way, and we need to protect them so that they function like public utilities. They take less risk, but they also are less innovative, can do less for the public. And at the end of the day, their risks are guaranteed by the government. I think that's exactly the wrong way to go in financial regulation. We need regulation that encourages competition while protecting consumers. It's a balance that can be struck, but it is definitely not the direction we're moving in at the moment, unfortunately.
Bob Cutner?
Wait a minute. Dodd-Frank created a mechanism to force big banks to create so-called living wills, a resolution mechanism so that if a big institution were on the brink of failure, it would not be too big to fail. And the only reason Dodd-Frank was not more effective than it is because almost every Republican in the House and Senate sided with Wall Street and resisted the kind of regulation that would make it easier to get a handle on these so-called too-big-to-fail institutions. So I hope that Mr. Levin is sincere. I hope that some of his Republican brethren and sistren take him seriously, but that's not how the Republican Party voted when it came time to serious about too-big-to-fail.
The core of what Dodd-Frank does with the large banks, and I think
Dodd
the banks
Frank,
are too,
singular, thank you.
Dodd-Frank does, yeah. Yes, for Barney Frank, the congressman from Massachusetts. The core of what it does, I think the banks we have are much too large. They're much too consolidated. And the core of what Dodd-Frank does is protect those banks as so-called systemically important institutions. It allows them to survive when they shouldn't survive. It allows them to take risks that they should not take.
And that's one way of describing it. We got more to look at. Of course, they don't describe it that way. David in Williamstown, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I consider myself an independent with conservative leanings.
Okay.
And I'm 50 years old, and probably for the last 10 or 15 years, say 10 years, I've basically come to the realization that I need to accept more government than I would like, even though I certainly would like to see less regulation, less taxing, small business, and so forth, because you've got just a wave of political campaign contributions out there and corporations who will wash over the system, and they can't have monopolies by law, but do everything but have mm-hmm. that steamroll us. As a metaphor, I would just say that your guest, Yuval, he described some things that are close to my heart, but I see it as like having a sleek, shiny jet ski or a speedboat and attempting to cross an ocean of campaign contributions that's prone to tidal waves.
And special interests that would, what, buy position, buy influence?
Yeah, because if you're going to make these changes to government that are being spoken about, the yep. big elephant in the room is the elected officials, and they're so bought and sold. I think they're campaign bribes and not campaign contributions.
Yuval, how do you get market dynamism when you've got interests so deeply wired in now through our campaign contributions to our politics?
Well, I think you give them less to buy. You give them less to buy by having a smaller government. The problem we have is not that there's not enough government opposing business interests. The problem we have is that government is working together with large business to essentially consolidate and manage the economy in ways that they deem to be best, and thereby to limit competition and to prevent the kind of innovation and growth that we need. I also don't think, I've worked with a lot of politicians, I've seen a lot of politicians in both parties, I am not as cynical as that listener. I actually don't think politicians are bought and paid for. I think the people who give them money like what they're doing, but don't necessarily drive or control what they're doing. I don't think President Obama is doing what he's doing because his very large Wall Street donors want him to. I think it's what he believes in, and some of those Wall Street people agree with him, and so they give him money because they like what he's doing. The same thing happens on the right. It's not the case that our system is bought and paid for. But I do think that when it comes to minute decisions, administrative decisions, special interests do have enormous power over regulators and legislators. You would have less of that power if they had less power to make those kinds of minute decisions.
Our listener,
if
Matt,
they govern
writes,
for the sake of competition.
Yeah, our listener says, you're pushing the same policies, quoting here, that have hollowed out the middle class and enriched the 1%. The government is the only institution large enough that can pull us out of the current crisis we're in. He says this isn't pushing the reset button, it's pushing the ignore button. I mean, okay, we're getting polemical here, but you hear the fear there that this empowers people who already seem quite empowered.
Well, I do, but I think it's a little strange to say that what I'm pushing is the same thing that has done something or other in the past. What I'm pushing is a real transformation of the way we think about American government. What I'm pushing is a different kind of welfare state, a different kind of understanding of the government's role in encouraging economic growth, in helping the most vulnerable Americans, and in arranging the relationship between the citizen and the state. I simply wouldn't say that this is something that we've tried in the past and hasn't worked. What we've tried in the past is various approaches to the social democratic model in America.
Bob, I'll come to you.
Not complete approaches. We haven't gone that far, don't get me wrong. But I think that at the end of the day, we need a different way of thinking about the role of government in the life of a free society.
Let me get one more call here. Drew in Aiken, South Carolina. Drew, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Pretty well. What do you see?
I'd like to bring it back out to the macro level argument that we have going on here. Basically, the idea that Levin said earlier is that the goal is economic growth. Well, nobody can argue with that. That is everyone's policy. But the problem is the two different approaches that we have going on, the two beasts in the room that have been going on since the beginning of the parties. And the reality of that is that we have already tried Levin's ideas, but just under different excuses. And the idea that we can implement what he wants is a fantasy, basically because the idea that we all have liberal action, we all have liberal intention, but the problem is that we live in an incremental system where those kind of fantasies can't take place.
Why is it a fantasy? Why is it a fantasy, Drew? What do you mean?
Because he's asking for radical ideas in a very slow moving process. Everyone had great intentions to move out of Clinton into the Bush administration. The problem is that you stop using the word reset that Levin likes to use, and you start looking at reform that becomes ineffective. So this idea of back and forth, it's regressive. We need to take what we're working with now. And use that, because congressional gridlock is not going to allow us to get anywhere near Levin's motives.
Drew, our clock is running down. Bob Cutner, what looks possible here? What looks right to you here?
I think the admission that government tends to get captured by powerful interests, I can agree with that. I just want to flag one thing that I think calls into question the whole recipe. He uses the word premium support as his reform of Medicare.
On Medicare,
that's a polite word for voucher.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with it is, if you give an elderly person $6,000 or $7,000 and say, "Go out and find a health insurance policy," and a decent health insurance policy for an elderly person costs $15,000. You're basically saying, hey, if you've got private resources, if you're in the top 5 or 10%, you can get a decent policy. But if you're my mother and you're living mostly on Social Security, you get a bare-bones policy that doesn't cover stuff when you're sick, that has deductibles and copays. That's the problem with turning Medicare into a voucher. It's also, by the way, problem with the proposal of turning schools into vouchers, because the for-profit schools skim off all the cream. Nobody wants to deal with the special needs kids. And you leave the public system with the hardest kids, and then you say, look, the public schools are failing. So I think it's fine in theory, but when you drill down and look at the particular proposals, it's the same old stuff, and it's socially unjust, and it's not good economics.
Robert Cutner, co-editor of The American Prospect. Thanks for joining us, Bob. Yuval, our time is running straight out here, but Mitt Romney, is he carrying your torch or not?
Well, it's hard to say. He's been awfully vague about what he wants to do, so I hope it turns out that way, but I can't claim to know.
Do you think his gut is to go for, you know, the big reset, sort of the big change that you're hoping for here?
I think his gut is to go for reform. Reset is not a word that I would use to describe what I want to do or what he wants to do, but, you know, I think it remains to be seen exactly where he's headed. I hope he tells us.
The full essay, including the prompts to Mitt Romney, at our website, onpointradio.org. It's called Our Age of Anxiety, from the Weekly Standard. Yuval Levin, the author. Yuval, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.